This is the hubbub of archaeologists getting very excited, Helen.
It is, and that's because we're at Current Archaeology Live. We are in the bit that's called the Archaeology Fair, so we can see all sorts of exciting stalls around us, and we're going to be at Current Archaeology Live for this edition of the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to the Time Team podcast, Martin Williams and Helen Geek, bringing you a slightly different episode because we're on the road. We are in London. We're in central London at University College London at Current Archaeology Live, which is a big celebration of archaeology, but also it's the chance for archaeologists to learn from other archaeologists about their work. There's going to be awards later on, which we will bring you some of the aftermath of. But where we are right now, well, I mean, what's going on here, Helen? Because we're in the middle of a very busy room with lots of stalls all around it.
Yes, now we've got various stalls. We've got a bookstall, Archaeopress over there, and we've got a couple of university departments. We've got UCL Institute of Archaeology there. We've got Kent Archaeological Field School touting for business as well. We've got lots of tour operators offering holidays. We've even got some projects with stalls that you can go and find out all about what their projects are doing.
So this is where we are at the moment. Just about sort of 20, 30 metres away from us is the big auditorium, and that's where lots of talks are taking place. Our very own Naomi Sue Paul is here. She's just arrived, ready to give her talk a little bit later on. And so we're going to try and bring you a bit of a flavour of this event. We're going to be wandering around this room. We're going to be in the auditorium. We're going to be where people are eating their lunch and sort of grabbing them as they walk by to bring you a bit of a flavour of Current Archaeology Live.
Now, we've come into the auditorium here at the Institute of Education at UCL, and it is absolutely massive, but pretty much empty at the moment because everybody's having lunch. But who we have managed to find is Carly Hiltz, who is the editor of Current Archaeology, and you've organised this whole day, haven't you, Carly? It's one of you've been running Current Archaeology Live events for some time, haven't you?
Yes, well, I've been editor of CA for 7 or 8 years now, and it falls to the editor to help organise. But I will say, help organise. I have a wonderful team, and my colleagues have worked super hard as well. So, yeah, really chuffed. It's a really good day so far.
I'm really pleased to hear it, and I just snuck in just a few moments ago during one of the talks, and everybody's gripped, and the whole place is full as well, which is wonderful. What is the reason for holding this event?
Well, largely to celebrate the wonderful diversity of archaeology that we have across the UK and further afield. We've had colleagues speaking about British projects, and we've had a wonderful ancient Egypt talk earlier today. That's why we work in partnership with the Institute for Archaeology here at UCL, because obviously they prioritise to the, you know, studying archaeology, and it's about celebrating what makes our field really interesting, drawing people together to hear more about the past.
Yes, I've been struck by the diversity of the talks this morning because I got here absolutely bright and early because I was determined to hear the first one because it was partly about an excavation that's happened just a few miles from my house. But he was linking, Kevin, who gave the talk, he was linking aspects of that with aspects of other work, other field work he's done in West Africa. That global approach is so useful and so interesting. And then what with the ancient Egypt and with Yorkshire and with all the other places in Britain that we're going to look at through the course of the day, it widens your horizons, doesn't it, Carly?
It shows how many different disciplines come together to help illuminate the past, and yes, how much we can learn from talking to colleagues who are focusing on different periods, different places. It really does all come together, you're right.
Well, we're going to be spending the next little while milling around, trying to talk to as many people as we possibly can and learn as much as we possibly can. What are some of the big events, the big sort of standout moments today that Helen and I need to make sure that we see?
Well, most importantly, we've got the Current Archaeology Awards at the end of the day, after David Breeze has given his keynote speech, which is also one you shouldn't miss. That'll be great fun. He's talking about Hadrian's Wall. He's brilliant. But the Archaeology Awards, celebrating the people and the publications and the projects that have made such an important contribution to archaeology over the last 12 months, we will be holding those at about 5 o'clock and announcing the results. It's very exciting.
So we're back in the Archaeology Fair, and I'm now talking to Professor David Breeze, who is the keynote speaker of the day. David, you're an expert on Hadrian's Wall, aren't you? Which bits are you going to draw out? I mean, it's a big topic.
Well, I was asked to give the keynote because this year is the 50th anniversary of the publication of my first book on Hadrian's Wall, which was, as it were, the new history of the wall when it came out. I was asked by Carly to talk about how things have changed, but she also asked me to talk about my career. So I'm reduced to about 20, 25 minutes on Hadrian's Wall, and a lot has changed in 50 years. But there are some issues which are the same as they have been, same discussions, the same arguments of the last 100 years. Basic one is, was there a wall walk along the top of Hadrian's Wall? Because if there was, you could fight from the top of it, possibly. If there wasn't, it's a different kettle of fish. And that argument still goes on.
I always find it interesting how our arguments change, how what we're interested in changes. But Hadrian's Wall stayed remarkably kind of, people are still deciding whether it's essentially military or it's essentially a kind of control customs post, aren't they? And I think it depends almost on the person. It's less on the politics of the day and more a personal feeling, whether you are someone who usually thinks that people fight with each other or you usually think that people trade with each other.
And what are your thoughts, David?
Well, I think we've just caught it. It's exactly the case. I have started off a lecture about this subject with a glass half full of water and said, whether you see this half empty or half full, it's the same with trying to understand Hadrian's Wall. If you think in terms of, like I do, the superiority of the Roman army, it doesn't really matter whether you've got people on the top. And they haven't got the right weapons anyway. And we know from everything, all our information about the Roman army, if they came under attack, they'd go out in the field to deal with the enemy, where their better training, better weapons, discipline, and so on, generally gave them the victory. But there are a lot of other people who think of it differently and have the idea that the army was defending Hadrian's Wall and fighting from the top sometimes.
And other people who believe that it's merely performative, that you build a big wall to show that you can. You could do this if you wanted to. Of course, you're not going to really because it's a bit of a bother and maybe you don't need to. But Hadrian's Wall, it's like the Great Wall of China, isn't it? It's huge in our imagination, and it must have been huge in the imagination of Scottish, or if that's not an anachronism, of people on both sides of the wall when it was built.
Yeah. And how well manned would it have been at the height of Rome's power?
Well, that's an interesting question too, because it changed over time. So the original idea was for a simple barrier, as it might be marking the end of Caesar's territory, with relatively small military establishments, installations along the line. So eventually they might have started out at 32 men in each, then they came down to 8 men. And then something happens and they put forts on the wall, so they increase the number of men on the wall considerably. The crucial thing about the forts is it changes it from a passive line to an offensive line, because the forts uniquely in the Roman Empire project to the north. So what it's saying to me anyway is that Hadrian had come up with this way of thinking, okay, he thinks, I want barriers. I want to, you know, stop expanding the empire. We want a barrier. But perhaps when he came to Britain and saw the wall being built, he thought, we need more than this. And it's not necessarily a piece of historical fiction, because there are about 50 military units in Britain at the time. Over 20 of these have to move to fulfill this change. And generally speaking, we think that it would be only somebody as high as the emperor who would take such a decision. So I think that what's happening is Hadrian comes on the scene and increases the strength of the units and the number of soldiers on the wall, abandoning most of the forts in Wales, southern parts of the northern England, in order to man his new wall.
It is such an interesting subject, isn't it? And it's so enigmatic for people, I think. You know, you get there's almost a romance to Hadrian's Wall. But what is it for you? Why are you so interested in Hadrian's Wall, David?
It's a difficult question to answer how people are interested in a subject. So I'm about to give a lecture, and the lady who invited me said, talk about your career. So my interest in history started when I was 10, talking to my grandmother about family history, and then I interviewed all my elderly relatives. I bet you wish you did that.
Yeah.
And I have the record of what they thought. But interestingly, they only could go back two generations. That's all. But I think that's what sparked my interest, family history. And then I went to university with no idea of studying the Romans. And then the professor of archaeology happened to be my tutor. And that was it, Eric Burley.
Eric Burley, one of the great, great names of Hadrian's Wall, the Vindolander, the paterfamilias of Vindolander.
So you had no choice. Well, look, David, best of luck with the keynote later, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Standing next to me is Dr. Rebecca Jones, who earlier on gave a really, really interesting talk. And one of the things that I've been hearing about this talk was something that you've been, a little experiment you've been running with ChatGPT and archaeologists. Can you just explain?
This is mainly the work of my co-speaker, Tatiana Rivleva. And what she's done is she's been putting into models, asking questions. And what's been fascinating is you ask questions about, you know, Romana, British archaeologist, and you ask questions about male archaeologists, and it comes back with all the names you've heard of, lots of information about them, relatively accurate. You ask the same question you ask about women, and it comes back with gobbledygook. It invents them.
One of them is even more awful in that it's the name of a real Anglo-Saxon archaeologist, but they've given her the wrong dates, they've given her the wrong academic specialism, and she must be hopping mad.
Well, I think it's because that's how these models work. They're scraping the internet, so it's found a name, but it's done incorrect. One of the other names, which we didn't show today, that came up when we said, you know, give us a famous archaeologist, gave us the name of Ada Lovelace. So we're immediately scurrying around going, Ada Lovelace did archaeology? I didn't know that. And actually, when Tatiana then started querying it, it came back and said, oh no, that is incorrect. So it admitted to us that it was wrong.
It's really awful because women were part of Romano-British archaeology. It wasn't all just men who were interested in forts and Roman soldiers. There were plenty of women, weren't there, Becky? It's a thing that the archaeology has always been a subject that is pretty much equally open to men and women because it's a new subject without the same kinds of hidebound blocks and bottlenecks that traditional subjects like maybe, I don't know, chemistry or something might have. It's always been an inclusive discipline. And to find out that actually that's not the way that the internet thinks about it is really quite horrifying.
Yeah, and one of the things we've been talking about is these people being hidden in plain sight. Because actually, if you look for them, you find them. There was a whole stooshy in Scotland a few years ago when there was a picture of women at Scarborough Brae holding trowels, and they were being described as tourists and things like that. And of course, the comment was, they're holding trowels. And of course, they've since been identified, and they're two key pioneering archaeologists of the 1920s and 30s. So there are women there. I mean, one of the things that we didn't talk about in the paper, but is also part of it, is obviously to get into archaeology in that time period, there's a level of wealth that you needed to have, because it wasn't, you know, unless you were one of the sort of completely unnamed labourers, it was a sort of rich person's hobby. But there were plenty of women with enough wealth to pursue this as a hobby in the 19th and early 20th century.
Miss Wagstaff and Miss Lack, the photographers at Sutton Hoo, they were thought of as photographers, not as archaeologists.
But they were specialising in archaeology, presumably. So yes, they were archaeologists. And it's, you know, one of the things we've been pulling out is it the areas that they chose to specialise in, and the fact that a lot of them published amazing stuff, but in local journals. They didn't write the sweeping, this is Roman Britain as I know it, type monographs, which is what makes them a household name. But actually, those books by the household names are all built on this huge body of work by women scholars who are far less known. And of course, some changed their names when they got married, and some published purely with their initials, so that actually you don't necessarily know whether it's a man or a woman when you're dealing with a published paper, unless you've heard of the person.
Clearly then, there is work to do. As the bell goes to tell us to go back in, which we will in a moment, what do you think needs to change and what can change to improve the situation?
I think it's a lot of it's about getting more information out there. I'm also involved in a project where we're updating Wikipedia entries and creating new Wikipedia entries, because actually the more you improve the information that is out there, the better these AI models will get, because we have to give them accurate data to use. So for us, it's doing the research and then making that information available.
or we're going to let you go because the bell has gone and people are making their way back into the auditorium and we should go as well, yeah, Helen.
Also, I've just spotted Anna Jekko, who is involved with the Carlisle excavation. I really want to introduce you to her.
Okay, well, we shall... We'll do that later when they come out from the next round. We shall disappear now and we'll bring you more from Current Archaeology Live on the Time Team podcast shortly.
Okay, so good afternoon, everybody. I'm Naomi Sue Paul, I'm Time Team's environmental archaeologist.
This is the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, and we're in the auditorium at the Institute of Education at UCL in London, where Naomi Sue Paul has just finished her talk for Archaeology Live. So we're into a break now. Naomi, how do you think it went?
Good, I hope. It went very, very quick. I didn't think I'd have enough to fill the time, and yeah, it just went really, really quick. But I've been speaking to some people that were listening to the talk and they seem to have enjoyed it, and you know, people even now, you know, people were saying I've just never heard of flotation, or I've never seen the flotation tank. So you know, I think it's important to show that beginning process of on all the work, and you know as well, Helen, because you have helped me on the tank before, especially with the emptying out, and it's not an easy job. It's a lot of graft to get those teeny tiny things, and that's when the real work then begins.
Yeah, I really like the way you divided it into the dry bit. Sorry, that's the wrong way around. Yeah.
The wet bit, the dry bit.
And the microscopy bit. That's it. Yes, I really like that. To you, Martin, yeah. Because I felt you made it really clear exactly how you do this and that it's not just the magic of turning up and saying, look, I've got 2 grains of barley. You've gone from a 40-litre sample in the field all the way through everything to come out with the answer at the end. And I thought that was a really good way of looking at it, didn't you, Martin? That you start off with what you want to know, and then you told us how you get there, and then in the end you got the answer, which is probably like only one sentence for days and days of work, but it shows people how you come to that conclusion.
We've spoken a lot about what you do with the flotation tank and its use. How different is it explaining it to people in this room compared to when you're talking to members of the general public?
Absolutely no different. I explain it the same time, in the same way, with the same kind of words, the vocabulary. I mean, Sutton, who I got a lot of chance to speak to people, and people aren't stupid. They want to know the intricacies, and it starts with the simplicity of that. And they look at first at the tank and go, what is this? But within minutes, you explain what the process is and what you can get out of it and what that then means archaeologically, and their minds are blown. And so I always explain it the same way every time. And actually in this room, yes, there are archaeologists, but there's a lot of members of the general public, people that are readers of Current Archaeology magazine because they love archaeology as a hobby as well.
You've got lots of beginners, haven't you, here? And that's the thing about subscribing to a magazine. You often do that right at the start of your journey towards being an archaeologist, because that's how you get to find out what the world is and what's going on. Mm-hmm. So you have to look around this auditorium and think that there are people who've, like David Neal, who've been archaeologists their entire life and they're now in their 80s, and people who thought 6 months ago, I'd quite like to be an archaeologist, mm-hmm. I'll subscribe to the magazines and off we go.
And so therefore, do you think you have people here who are now seeing that, oh, maybe flotation is something that would help me in my work or my studies or my interest, and then are discovering this whole new way of finding out things from the soil?
Definitely. I mean, where I'm, you know, I've just become environmental supervisor in my new job in Allen Archaeology.
Oh, yeah, congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much. So now I have 2 jobs, so I'm not busy at all. But yeah, they started very, very small and did a bit of flotation, but they're trying to build the company, and that's why they've employed me, because they want to build that up in-house in terms of processing, report writing, because they didn't have that. So yeah, I think maybe people do think that, even smaller companies, because technically you should sample, all sites should sample, but if you don't have that facility, you might sample and then the soil goes off elsewhere. But I think once you can see the merit of it, then it's really a good thing to have in-house.
I was going to ask you about that, because one of the things that you said in your talk today was the benefits for Time Team excavations of having the flotation that you do on site and doing it there and then. What is the benefits of that as opposed to bagging it all up and then sending it off somewhere?
Ultimately, you will get the same answers, and that will be fed into the report, and you will still build that archaeological picture? Well, theoretically,
yeah. Well,
you'll
get the same answers, but you won't be able to ask the same questions, will you?
Not necessarily. And I mean, which site were we on with Cherrington, with that hearth in the centre, and we wanted a piece of dating evidence. The last thing that we had left to go for in those final hours was the soil, and it was a tiny piece of pottery, but it came up. And you know, I remember speaking to Tim saying there were so many times back in the day we need some dating evidence. Open another trench or open this, and it wasn't fruitful. Probably was. It was hidden in the soil.
Yeah, that's the trouble. That if you know what the answer is, 3 months, 6 months later, you haven't been asking the right questions on site. Mm-hmm. It's having that instant feedback that's really important.
And it helps now as well, you know, going forward and being involved in the WSI process and sort of looking at what we've got and trying to make as best a plan as possible that you can, rather than people taking samples but not with an environmental archaeologist having input, because that makes a lot of difference in terms of time, money, processing, all of that. So, and I think across the last 5 years, the soil has come up trumps for pretty much all of our sites, and hopefully going forward. And bring it on. Bring it on.
That's your new tagline. The soil has come up trumps. I like that a lot. Well, well done, Naomi. And what was it like speaking to a massive room of hundreds of people?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, I spent, you know, across 15 years teaching at two universities. It was a big stage, I must admit. And I was worried that I wouldn't be able to be seen behind the lectern and that I'd just be a disembodied voice. I did think about wearing a hi-fi just in case people were like, oh. But yeah, it wasn't too bad. Once the lights went down, you couldn't really see people, but I was just too busy. Just, you know, once you start, it's like action, go.
You're
just
in the zone.
Just like being on site, really, with a camera in your face.
Well, well done.
Thank you very much.
And that the applause for Jane Kershaw, who has just won Archaeologist of the Year. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm pretty stunned.
You look pretty stunned, actually. You weren't expecting it.
No, I was happily sat in the back row. I think the other two people who were up for this award are extremely distinguished, have led very full and wonderful academic careers, and I just hadn't thought I was in for a chance, really.
Well, I suppose, Jane, the thing is that you're still on the up, aren't you? I mean, you're still developing this really interesting conjunction between scientific work and historical work. You started off as a Viking Age specialist, and you've become a scientist, haven't you, by working with colleagues and so on, and you've ended up transforming our ideas about the Vikings and the way that they saw metal, bullion, jewellery, all sorts of things. So that makes you slightly different, because you combine those two worlds of the humanities and the sciences.
I think I'm, yes, because although I never did science A-levels even, but I think I'm not afraid of the science, and I think it's really important as archaeologists. We're mongrels, aren't we? We use whatever methods we can to get the results of the questions that we're interested in. And I'm not afraid to use those scientific methods, you know, but absolutely working with colleagues with expertise in those areas all the way along. But yeah, so I've been looking at lead isotope analysis and trying to understand the sources of Viking silver through lead isotope and trace element analysis. So taking geochemical approaches and working with colleagues in earth sciences to help do that.
Can I ask then, what is it exactly that you are working on that is going to help archaeologists across the world?
Looking at archaeological material, so Viking silver rings and ingots, and we're analysing them for two things. One is the lead isotope ratios, because silver will naturally contain lead that stems, one hopes, from the original ore, and working out the ratios of those lead isotopes can help to provenance, a bit like using, you know, strontium isotopes or oxygen isotopes for human remains can help identify potential sources of childhood origin and rule out others. And lead isotope analysis can do the same for silver.
It's one of the big questions, isn't it, that where does all this metal come from? So at various points you get shortages and then you get gluts. So in the 7th century, the Anglo-Saxons all of a sudden have massive amounts of gold, and we don't know whether that's just in some way a fashion or whether some source of gold has become available. And the Vikings don't use so much gold, but they have vast amounts of silver. And is this coming from, I don't know, Roman silver, Byzantine silver in the Mediterranean, or is it coming from new silver mines in Germany? many. These questions are what we want the answers to, and this is what Jane does. She tells us where the silver has come from and how many hands it's passed through, remelting and recycling and so on. So you can potentially tell not just what the Vikings wanted to do, but how they were doing it.
And what's really striking through the geochemical analysis is that we can see the silver is coming in from the Islamic world in massive quantities, far more than we would have anticipated. And the Vikings are obtaining the silver from an earlier date than we thought as well. So it changes our understanding of the flows of metal, but also what are the origins of the Viking Age? You know, what prompts this massive movement out of Scandinavia in the first place? The quest for silver is definitely part of that answer.
That's always been a huge question, hasn't it? Where, why? These small Scandinavian countries, why, how did they manage to dominate Northern Europe so much? But then the other thing that comes out of Jane's research is it kind of shrinks the world. You realise that these places aren't so far away from each other, and that people could travel, and that flows of metal can happen. We can see the metal moving where it's harder to see the people moving, and it makes you realise that somebody who perhaps grew up in Norway could be friends with somebody who grew up on the shores of the Black Sea, and they would be part of the same community.
And that's one of the questions we get so often on the Time Team podcast, is people wanting to know the relationship that people here had with people in other parts of Europe and how much communication they had going on. And sounds like this is a way of proving the extent to which that communication took place. What are you going to do from now then? What's the sort of research plan? Where does it go from here, the work you're doing?
Well, one, I've got two strands. I guess one is a more sort of popular one, which is that I really like maps, and so I want to make a book of Viking maps, which is partly about providing a very visual guide to those very long distance connections, which are so intriguing and which make the world so small. Academically, I think there's great potential to look at the North Sea economy in the post-Roman period. We've done some work looking at the introduction of the first silver coinage after the Romans left and working out where that silver came from. It's definitely a paradigm that can be applied to lots of different places and lots of different times. So I just want to expand the use of that paradigm and to show archaeologists that these tools are not off limits.
Well, congratulations once again. And how are you going to be celebrating your win?
I think we're going to the pub, aren't we?
Hey, that sounds good. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Just stepped out for a quick break, and Nigel, Louise and Jeremy are here from Time Team Test Bit 3, some of our wonderful Time Team members who have joined us on site before, and you were in a test bit number 3, and you've become friends and you've stayed friends, and now you do things like this, do you, Jeremy?
We do, yes. This is the second year we've all come to this.
Louise, what have you enjoyed so far about about current archaeology life?
Oh, it's really lovely being in a place where you've just got this kind of intense learning opportunity, Love the Iron Age hoards. That was just, for me, that was so interesting, just getting so up close to it, because you, even if you're reading it in a magazine or you see it on a website or whatever, it's not quite the same as having somebody literally unpicking it before you.
What's the most interesting thing that you've learnt, Nigel, so far?
One of the interesting talks was on whiskey.
Do you know what? I arrived just as that one was ending, and I thought I would have really liked to have learned more about that.
Yeah, it was really good. He had some samples as well, but there wasn't enough to hand around to all the audience. No, it was the fact that during the period of time when whiskey was heavily taxed, and lots of places up north in Scotland went and did their own little private distilleries, which were hidden, of course, because the revenue men would want to come along and take the stuff away. So that was quite a challenge. So there, they were on one National Trust site. I think they found a couple of dozen hidden distilleries. Well, they were all built in the rocks and stuff. You really had to go and struggle to find them, and that was fascinating.
That sounds very interesting. Well, I'm going to leave you guys to it and enjoy the rest of your time here today.
Thank you. Great.
So we're now here with Dr. Sophie Adams from the British Museum, and you've won the award for the Rescue Project of the Year, haven't you, for the Melsonby Hoard, which is the most extraordinary unbelievable project that I, because you talked to us about it this morning before we knew that you'd won the award, my chin was on the floor thinking this is so staggering. The find is staggering, and what you've done with it is staggering.
Thank you. Yeah, it's incredibly exciting to have a find that was wonderful to work on, and then to be awarded for doing the work on it is really, you know, fantastic. And it's a real team project. So working with the University of Durham University and Historic England, who helped fund it, and the finder, who was really, you know, helpful with kind of reporting the site to the Portable Antiquities Scheme. But it is massive, and it's been an incredible amount of work just to excavate, to record. Conservation work will be going on in the future, so it's currently stable. It's been acquired by Yorkshire Museum, so it will be going on display soon in its stabilised but not fully shiny state.
Goodness, I can see how excited you are just by the look on your face. Let's get some facts here. Let's explain what is the Melsonby Hoard? Where was it found? What does it consist of?
Three guesses as to where it was found, Mark.
All right, Helen. I don't know where Melsonby is.
So North Yorkshire. So it was found near Melsonby. So we're not far from the what's known as the Royal Site of Stannoch. It falls in what we traditionally term the Iron Age. So it's right at this period just before the Romans have invaded Britain, and radiocarbon dates from the hoard confirm this. So we're late 1st century BC, early 1st century AD. It's really two hoards. So it's two groups of material, all mostly to do with horses, vehicles, a few little bits of weapons, no personal adornments, one possible bead, and an iron mirror as well.
Yeah, that's a really strange thing, isn't it? Because we're used to seeing these bronze mirrors. Yeah. And an iron mirror, I suppose you have to keep it incredibly clean, very well oiled so it doesn't rust, but potentially you could get a really good shine on that, couldn't you?
Yes, it would be a lovely kind of silvery object. Mm. And it's really hefty as well, so it's not something that you just kind of, you know, slightly move around. It would look dramatic when you're wielding this mirror.
There's just so much iron, isn't there, in these hoards? And I know we call it the Iron Age, but actually we see very, very little iron from this date. And I was really swept away by the amount of iron and the amount of effort that has gone into making all these iron tyres and iron pins and iron and the iron mirror. It's a triumph of blacksmithing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. So the iron tyres, there was only one that had to be cut to remove it from the pile in the ditch. And slicing through it, the iron was still silvery coloured inside. So it was really good quality, good condition. Although conservation-wise, that's a problem because there's all that iron still to corrode. But they're also, some of them, really quite massive as well. So they're not your delicate, tiny, thin rings that you see on the kind of earlier East Yorkshire chariot burials. It's something a lot more hefty.
Can we just talk about how the conservation has gone? Because you've done something quite brave with the two different hoards, haven't you? One has been cleaned and conserved in the traditional way, and the other one has been left. And there could be all sorts of things inside this other hoard that's been stabilised but left so that we can see what you saw as it came out of the soil. I love that idea that you've got one original and one beautiful so that you can see what a conservator does. But I can imagine that it's quite a difficult decision to do because people might say, well, how do you know that there isn't something unbelievable lurking in there?
It's an incredible... The block is what we're calling it at this second hoard. And it's really an artefact in itself because it's this moment, this action of bundling up this material, probably in a textile, and put it in the ground, and that's preserved. And so what we're able to show with it still as a block is that action, that human action, which so often gets sort of taken apart as you excavate. We have amazing CT scans. So Southampton University did some really detailed CT scans. So we can see most of what's in it. And one of the problems is if you start taking it apart, you break things. So which object do you sacrifice to get to the other objects within?
Yes, it's always a problem, isn't it, that you have to do so much remedial work when you're a conservator, and that it's a job that's absolutely full of really tricky decisions. I've always been very glad I'm not a conservator because you have to be so brave about things. It takes a particular personality type, I think. But I'm longing to see it at the Yorkshire Museum when it goes on display.
Yes, so the block will be on display and also some of the artefacts. So I think it's an interesting term that's often used. People talk about cleaned artefacts. I think it's not really a term that conservators builders use, because what they're doing is working through the layers of information on it. So they might be moving the layers of the soil, and that can be assessed, and then they might be looking at the layers of corrosion. So at this point, those layers of corrosion are still on the object, because that may preserve information that we can learn as we slowly work through that in the future. So it's been conserved to be a future project for further research. And in the way that there's a hoard at the British Museum, the Stanek hoard, which we think was found somewhere in this area as well, it's also been known as the Melsonby hoard, and that was found in 1843. And at that time, the habit was to clean off everything on the surface, so all that information's gone. So now we can compare that old technique with the new processes of conservation.
Taking off the soil is cleaning in a way, but what you don't want to do is strip. You've got to leave its patina and its laughter lines in a way, haven't you? But knowing where to stop is really hard.
Well, congratulations once again. I can already tell that there is so much more work to be done and so much more hard work from you and the rest of your team. So very best of luck with that and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, that is about it from us on the Time Team podcast from the current Archaeology Awards. We are about to go to the, well, in true Time Team fashion, really, we're about to go to the pub.
We are, indeed,
we?
Yes.
Because a lot of the winners from here and lots of other people that have been taking part in this event are going to be there. And that is where we're going to record our bonus edition of the podcast, which you can get right now on Patreon. If you are a Time Team member at patreon.com/timeteamofficial, which is where you go to get loads more from Time Team, including bonus episodes and ad-free episodes of this podcast, you can go and you can hear what we got up to, chatting to some more experts and archaeologists and people with a fascination for this subject in the pub just after the current Archaeology Awards. Have you had a nice time?
I've had a lovely day. It's been such a variety of different talks and different people, and I've met so many old friends, and it's been absolutely lovely.
What was your favourite talk?
Oh, well, I must say David Breeze on Hadrian's Wall was
It was good. He's funny, isn't he? He's a funny guy.
He's really funny. He's really funny. I mean, he spent 40 years as Scotland's kind of top civil servant in heritage, and I've always been a bit frightened of him, but I met him properly for the first time today, and he's lovely.
He really was, and it was very interesting hearing his talk as well. I think that might be my favourite. And also, there was a brilliant talk on the work that they're doing at the Houses of Parliament, the Palace of Westminster as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, that was so fascinating to see how the Thames has changed its shape and how a sandy island in the Thames in the Anglo-Saxon period has now become the Houses of Parliament that we all know about. It had so much, that talk.
That was really, really interesting. I think we probably need to feature that on the podcast at some point in the future, because that was really, really great. Thank you for your company, and we will see you next week on the Time Team podcast, when we are going to be back talking about the Celts. Really interesting conversation that we've had with the guy who quite literally wrote the book on the Celts. He's just written a book on the Celts, and you will meet him. It's a fascinating conversation. Do join us for that next week on the Time Team podcast from London. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.